You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A really old and big circus mural was uncovered at a bar in western Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll hear the story behind the artwork and how it was found. Now, the FBI says it's opened more than 160 criminal cases related to the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol last week by a mob of pro-Trump extremists, which included white supremacists, QAnon conspiracy theorists, and others. A lot of questions remain about how the security breach was able to happen, despite FBI officials saying on Friday they had no intelligence suggesting the president's rally could turn violent. The Washington Post reported that the Bureau's Norfolk office had alerted its D.C. branch about specific threats made in online forums. The New York Police Department also reportedly warned the Capitol Police Force about threats of violence before last Wednesday. Our next guest says that given the warnings last week and well before that, the attack shouldn't have come as a surprise and that right-wing extremism is a significant concern for the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how law enforcement agencies watch for and respond to threats of domestic terrorism? Do you think the events at the Capitol qualify as that? Are you worried about far-right extremism and the risk of more violence in the near and midterm future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Clint Watts is a distinguished research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and a former FBI counterterrorism analyst. He's the author of Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. Clint, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Clint, I was following your Twitter feed on the events of last Wednesday. Shocking they were, but you say not really surprising. Why not?
All the way back to, I would say, August timeframe. I have a couple research teams that I work with, and it was very clear that the biggest danger was going to be mobilizations in and around the election, particularly on election day to polling places, if it was thought to be contentious and close. And we did see a little bit of that. One thing that held it up is the election was so close, no one knew where to mobilize to. And we were watching for the president and others who were claiming that the election was rigged or voter fraud. We were watching to see if they would point to anywhere. And Philadelphia was really one of the first places, you know, on his Twitter feed. And you saw a couple extremists show up there and they were arrested. But it was mostly good news, but you could see it building. And so I think most of President Trump's supporters that believe the election fraud claims were still waiting, and January 6th became their last hope. That was, it was resolving itself. As soon as that happens, that's the transfer of power, and it's over. And so it was clear probably 2 weeks before that this big mobilization was going to happen. They were putting out maps across a variety of extremist channels. QAnon sort of fan clubs were posting that people should travel to D.C. for the Stop the Steal. It was very organized. There was a large rally the day before, and it was clear from those discussions that some people had violent intentions. So if you were watching it, there should have been no way you were surprised. And I think that's why we're finding out about law enforcement giving warnings in this space.
When we look at the people in the Capitol, I mean, early on, it looked like, okay, some protesters who happened to be there wandered in when they found an opening. But as we saw it more and more, it looked more violent and more organized. Can you talk about the composition from known right-wing extremist groups to, you know, protesters who followed the surge? What did we see from the people who ended up in the Capitol that day?
I think what you saw was the confluence of a lot of different factors. Look, you have people that are just President Trump supporters, right? And they came out there because he called them to a rally and he was there. He gave a speech. But intermixed in there, in terms of any extremist group, you're always going to have people or any ideology that is arguing with the outcome of the election, you're going to have extremists that are mobilizing to violence enmeshed in them. And that's true of any large gathering, pretty much, or protest. And we saw that through the summer. You'll have some criminal elements, but you're also going to have your most ardent extremists who think this is their last chance. And for that, that was anti-government groups. That was some race-based extremist groups. And so you see them flow into the Capitol, and they're the leaders of it. And then what happens in behind is they have a mixed gathering of people that are flowing in. I think what is remarkable is the weapons, it's the Molotov cocktails, the explosive devices, people showing up with zip ties, people hunting for specific congressmen. I do wonder, had they gotten a hold of certain congressmen, what might have happened? Looking at the Michigan militia just months before, Wolverine militia, a variant of it essentially, that was planning to kidnap Governor Whitman. This talk has been out there, and you're seeing people plotting and planning. So I think we got lucky in the sense that while it was awful and devastating, it could have led to a congressman or a standoff or someone being murdered on the Senate floor.
You mentioned this was a last gasp effort to overturn the election result. Is it going to be the last gasp effort of the groups, the online communities that got us here?
Yeah, I think in the last couple of days, the intense law enforcement and military presence in Washington, D.C. is going to deter people from going to the nation's capital. I think in the sorry about that, it cut out for a second.
That's
I think in many of the extremist channels, you're seeing them start to dissuade their supporters. The president, I believe, did issue a memo today, you know, from the White House saying that people shouldn't mobilize. And so that has a downturn effect. My concern is that on the fringes of these groups, there are ones and twos that are mobilizing still and see the final days now until the inauguration is their last chance and that there's no turning back. So it becomes a question of if not now, when, right? Like, this is it. And so luckily, the FBI, I'm sure, is running down a lot of this. State and locals are doing a great deal of this. My final concern is just the overlap or tacit support of law enforcement or military as a vulnerability, you know, for these extremist groups if they have members with cross membership. But I do feel like things will not be what we saw on January 6th.
Talking to Clint Watts from the Foreign Policy Research Institute, former FBI counterterrorism analyst, looking at right-wing extremism and its threats. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Eli is with us in La Crosse. Eli, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, I have a question for your guest. So obviously, right-wing extremism is a problem, and we've seen that problem throughout history. But with the last year passing and all the protests and stuff and even storming up federal buildings in Washington, I'm just wondering why we didn't see the same mobilization afterwards of FBI and police units to track down those who were storming federal buildings then on, you know, from a radical left agenda than those who now stormed federal buildings in Washington last week.
Eli, thanks for the call. Clint, what do you think?
I'm not sure I entirely understand the numbers or statistics behind it. I mean, there were undercover groups in Portland, Oregon, arresting people off the streets preemptively, and I think after events throughout the summer. In terms of the mobilization and defense of the Capitol, there's a difference because the Capitol is ultimately commanded by the president, whereas in the states, the National Guard is commanded or mobilized by the governor. And so oftentimes the mobilizations you saw were dependent on state and local law enforcement and the governor in each state. So the response is somewhat predicated on whoever the chief executive is in charge of the forces around it. I think in the case of January 6th, part of the reason why we didn't see the response we should have and in a timely fashion is because there was such concern amongst people in the Department of Defense for months that the military was going to be pulled into the electoral process. And due to optics, they were trying as hard as they could to stay out of it. They did not want to see armed troops essentially going into the nation's capital for that rally or on that day with what was going on to the Capitol. Obviously, that's going to change now as a defensive posture. But I think the idea was that there had been calls amongst the conspiracy groups that the president should declare martial law and call in the military. And I think that made the military resistant to immediately mobilize and help out in and around D.C. on that day last week.
Thanks for the call, Eli. We'll go to Eric now in Madison. Eric, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What I find disturbing is the right-wing movement among our law enforcement officers, and you could see that in D.C. You can see it with Democrat governors and Matt.
We lost you there, Eric, but we get the gist, worried about white supremacy and law enforcement. You had mentioned that briefly, Clint. Can you talk about that concern a little more? You also mentioned the military. We have this statement from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the heads of all the military arms, saying this was sedition. Don't do this. What do you make of that risk that Eric raises?
Yeah, I'll start with the second part first, which is it was very clear there were former and even current military members that were at the Capitol, which is very disturbing. And, you know, in certain groups, the Proud Boys, for example, some of them that were storming in there, they were wearing their military patches, you know, and insignia and things like that from when they had served. So that is an issue because it brings into question, if we have several hundred current and recently former military people who are showing up there, how is that spread out into the active duty force? So I guarantee the Department of Defense is doing a hard look at that today, and in the coming months will be. Separately, in the law enforcement space, white supremacists, it has not been, I think, as pervasive as the militia groups. I think that's where the real concern is. You've seen militia groups where there's crossover or dueling membership between the militia group and law enforcement. And I think that's where things get very concerning. And a lot of the militia groups are founded, formed, staffed by former military people. So when you get that confluence, it starts to bring into question, would there be a challenge of allegiance to the state or to the group or to a cause or an ideology? I think that's what we need to be worried about, particularly in certain jurisdictions that are overwhelmingly for President Trump and believe in his election fraud claims.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Clint Watts right now, research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, former FBI counterterrorism analyst, looking at warning signs that led up to last week's attack on the Capitol and the threat of domestic extremism in the future. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Clint Watts, former FBI counterterrorism analyst, now research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, about domestic terrorism. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions about the dangers of extremism here in the United States. Clint, before we go back to our callers, I wanted to ask you about how to police this sort of thing. I think when we think of a terrorist group, we think of people who meet up in a cave, in a basement, in a remote woods somewhere or something like that. We have people meeting up on the internet, and maybe nine people who say extremist things will never do anything violent in their life. But what about that 10th one? How do you get a handle on that?
Yeah, so I think the problem is scale right now. There's just way too many threats for the manpower that's out there and way too many conflicting priorities. So just think of I'll use the FBI as an example, but you could include state and local law enforcement. Think of the pattern they've gone through over the last 2 years, being derided by the president over an investigation that occurred before the 2016 election. You know, that sort of discrediting, fighting that internally, doing election defense, whether you're at DHS or the FBI, trying to protect those systems against foreign influence while simultaneously watching the George Floyd protest and having to respond to that. You had the Nashville bombing on Christmas Day, and now you have the Capitol Hill fiasco last week. That's an overwhelming amount of leads, and it means that the extremism situation has grown to such an extent in the United States that it can't adequately be tracked because we would have known that it was coming. We've gotten to that point in international terrorism. If you rewind from 2001 all the way through to today, we've gotten much better with international terrorism. Rarely does it sneak up on us. You know, it's a lone wolf or someone who's really hidden their tracks. And the FBI is still very good at preempting that stuff. We don't have that kind of a picture on the domestic space. Part of it is because our laws are different. But the other part of it is also the acceleration of it has been so tremendous over the last 3 to 4 years. White supremacists, anti-government, accelerationists, which is a more extreme fringe of the white supremacist movement, but also just trying to accelerate a second civil war or bring about conflict for societal change. Those sorts of things have grown so quickly, and it's due to the interconnectivity of the internet and social media, and then provoking each other to essentially go ahead and conduct these attacks. And so that inspirational contagion becomes a problem. To fix this over time is going to be a difficult task for several different reasons. One, the pandemic is all-consuming, you know, to the country at this point. Closures, you know, mobilizing resources, we're just overrun. Second, it's we have to build unity in the country around common purpose. As long as we have a large chunk of the citizenry that thinks that the election was fraudulent or the outcome was rigged, we will have a problem bringing people together. That is, you know, not good. It's tough to defend all Americans in that case. And I think this is where the politicization of the military and the law enforcement over the last several years by the president really comes to roost. And that has degraded institutions that are designed to protect Americans. And in the past, it didn't matter who it was, Republican or Democrat. They always tried to do the right thing and bring people together. And I'm hoping we can guide that, but I think it'll be a long repair. It won't happen instantly.
Let's go back to our callers now. JT is with us in Madison. JT, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What you want to bring up?
Yeah, I had a question. Actually, I had a comment and a question. My comment is, I believe that this terrorist act on the state capitol is treason, and that it should be a felony charge. I don't know if it's a felony to break into the state capitol, but I believe that these people should be charged with a felony and lose their right to vote and lose their gun privileges because they're irrational thinkers. And also my question is, could foreign influences be using the social media platform to be spreading propaganda and false conspiracy theories that people are grabbing hold of? Those are my two questions. Thanks for taking my call.
JT, thanks for the call. He's referring to the U.S. Capitol there. But Clint, to his question, are foreign actors helping to exacerbate these conspiracy theories that help drive these things?
Yes, in two ways. For years now, specific foreign meddlers, Russia number one, but Iran as well, have been infiltrating different groups in the United States and agitating and provoking them through disinformation and conspiracies. And that polarization primes domestic groups then to fight with each other. There is foreign influence and nudging in the U.S. audience base right now on these extremist groups. You've already seen some of the foreign actors that we watch in social media start to point out where to go to, as many of these extremist groups have been deplatformed, they're pointing where to go to reconnect with your group on different platforms. And they're pumping content in there. You might also remember just a few weeks ago to a few months ago, there was a fake Proud Boys text message that was being shot around with respect to certain people showing up at polling places. It was a violent threat, but it was attributed to Iran. It was not American made. So they see weakness in our country, and they're trying to use that weakness to exploit and divide us.
I've heard some experts say, yes, Russia is exacerbating divisions. Others are, but we've gotten pretty good at it ourselves. Even without that foreign help, we'd have a lot of these problems. Is there something to that?
Yeah. 4 years ago, the Russians were hidden. People didn't realize they were interacting with, you know, foreign content. That is not the case in 2020. The disinformation, the conspiracies were American made. Headed into 2020. They were even touted by elected officials. Sure, the Russians amplified it. The Iranians will amplify it at times, or even the Chinese. But it's a drop in an ocean of conspiracy theories at this point. And so I think from the foreign perspective going into Election Day, the question, not only were they delighted to see us tear ourselves apart and fight amongst ourselves, but the question was, you know, what could Russia or Iran or China do to America that America wasn't already doing to itself?
In our last couple of minutes, the FBI recently has identified right-wing extremism as a major threat. There have been accusations that the Trump administration dialed down efforts against right-wing extremism. How well are we balanced in our efforts to prevent right-wing extremism versus the other potential sources of violence?
Yeah, so I think the FBI, up until this, you know, most recent point, and I think they probably just got overwhelmed, was doing a really good job of preemptively moving to, take out certain key individuals in these movements. After the Walmart shooting in El Paso, you saw them do a number of domestic arrests around these groups. And in the lead up to Election Day, it looked like they preemptively arrested a lot of people, what was known as kind of the Boogaloo movement. And that had a disruptive effect that was, I would imagine, very helpful at securing the polling places. The problem is capacity. The problem is resources. We just have not gotten there. And I also think there's sensitivity around the free speech question. Much of what is being said is being claimed to be political speech. But without wading too much into the campaigns, I mean, Rudy Giuliani was at the rally the day before, and he talked about it's time to move to essentially out of law and into combat. That is incitement to terrorism that, had it come out of the mouth of a Al-Qaeda cleric 10, 12 years before, when I was working on extremism, would have led to almost an immediate opening of an FBI case. You know, that is incitement. That's what we worried about with Al-Qaeda ideologues for a decade.
We'll leave it there for now. Clint, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Clint Watts is a research fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute and a former FBI counterterrorism analyst. He's the author of the book Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. He joined us for a look at the threat of right-wing extremism after last week's attack on the U.S. Capitol building. Coming up, we'll tell you about an unexpected find at a Western Wisconsin restaurant and all the media attention that followed. And coming up later, we'll look more at today's impeachment vote in the U.S. House. You can weigh in with your thoughts on it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the head of Wisconsin's Transportation Department joins us for a look at funding for special transit programs around the state aimed at meeting the needs of seniors and people with disabilities. Now we're revisiting an interview about an unexpected discovery at a Wisconsin restaurant. When our next guest was working to renovate his family's bar and restaurant, he found something he didn't expect, a massive mural of an ad for the circus. Turned out the poster was extremely old and in surprisingly good shape for its age. That's back in 2015. By 2018, local media were reporting on the poster, and outlets from farther and farther away became interested in the story. Ron Berger lives in the western Wisconsin community of Durand. His family has owned the Corral Bar and Riverside Grill for decades. Ron, welcome to Central Time.
Yes. Yeah, it was an interesting thing. You talk about turning life upside down. But, you know, it's still a good feel-good story, you know, versus the news. And, you know, we're getting kind of bombarded with things that aren't so pleasant. So it's still a feel-good story.
I think so, too. Now, describe what this poster looks like. Paint us a picture, if you can, of this really big circus ad.
Well, I guess he started out with what I used to, when I talked to a conservatory in Minneapolis and call up there and they asked what I found. Well, according to the historians, a 9-foot-tall, 55-foot-long, full-color, multi-sheet, woodblock cut, paper lithograph circus poster from 1885.
Wow.
And then you'd get silence.
55 feet long? Did you say that?
It actually went 60 feet long, where the 5 foot on the end was lost off in a saltwater aquarium piece, unfortunately, because that was a rare thing in the 1800s to have a mobile saltwater aquarium and a, you know, menagerie and circus type of train setting.
Now, your family had been working in this building for a long time. When you started to go at this wall, you had no idea this thing was down there, right?
Well, actually, we started out in 1977 with one building. My mom had purchased an old approximately 1816 stone building right off the Chippewa River in Durand. And in 1996, we purchased the building next door to it. and added a restaurant, you know, and kitchen in. And then in 2013, I want to say, my sister, you know, 2008, my sisters bought my mom out. And then 2013 or so, I bought that building next door. And it was a couple years of actually retailing. She renovated it for a kind of a secondhand store first, and our growth just got to where we could use it for a banquet room. And then the other, the secondhand store kind of, you know, is competing with a St. Vincent de Paul's in town and stuff, and that was kind of a hard deal in a small town, so that didn't work out. We ended up, you know, having a room available to do, you know, banquet-style stuff. So my job was just to kind of put a doorway through a common wall of the buildings. There's two, well, actually two building walls, but I actually, where I cut in is a perfectly located buffalo piece charging at me when I opened up the lath and plaster, complete with snort coming out the nostrils. So it's kind of an interesting type of thing. But, you know, that wasn't so surprising. I think, you know, because the first take was, it was just a green kind of a paper that I seen the first place where I ended up cutting a buffalo's tail off. But it ended up being a grassy plain behind the buffalo. But it was the same color, so there wasn't no artwork on that right there that I initially pulled. But once I started pulling plaster off and lath, there, you know, it revealed a Native American riding behind the buffalo, and then the buffalo horn and the head and all that stuff. And then on the bottom, Russell and Morgan Printing Company, Cincinnati, Ohio, on the bottom. Well, then, I, you know, you got to figure, oh, we've got something kind of odd here. And then to try to guess that the time period, it was kind of tough. You know, you just look at the, you know, it wasn't paint, you know, but it was a kind of a strange type of paper, and the artwork, it was kind of hard to figure out right away at first. We kind of first thought maybe a Buffalo Bill show, you know, a Wild West show when we first seen it, and thinking maybe it was just like a 6 by 6 foot maybe piece there. I think the more shocking thing was when we ended up taking the electrical box covers off on, you know, into the wall, and we shine light in there, and we seen this piece went the whole length of the wall. That was kind of like take your breath away. It's like, really, what the heck is they? What were they doing? You know, what is it? And the mystique, you know, for 5-6 weeks before I think that was on Labor Day weekend, and then it was October 13th before I actually pulled all that lath and plaster off to reveal what it was.
Now, this thing's knocking on the door of 150 years old. What kind of shape is it in?
According to historians, it's remarkable shape. This is a paper outside design billboard, you know, that was stamped, you know, in layered colors also, but it was, from everybody tells me that in the know, that it was made to last only like 2 to 3 weeks maybe outside. First rainstorm, it'd soak up moisture, the glue would release, and the fibrous paper would break down and just go into the ground, so they didn't have to send a team of people back to take them down after the show. So they're specifically, supposedly designed to weather away. So the anomaly is that it survived in the kind of shape that it is. It had to be the perfect storm where they were in a process of probably, I think I got enough evidence to support in a court of law that they're building, in the process of maybe working on the foundation of building a new building next door. And they seen where the river come right at Duran there, and that was becoming the world's greatest logging river, or was the world's greatest logging river in 1885. So they were wanting to advertise the river as well as townspeople, and the train come in 1882, a block or two away, and you just looked at the area, and everything was centrally located. The, you know, the hotels, the other businesses. It was actually a hardware store that they put the poster on. So I think they were working on this masonry front saloon when the circus advertisers come into town, and they seen the wall, and they kind of stopped them in their tracks and kind of, could you please wait till after the show to build this building? You know, could we use it? Because it's a perfect location. They probably threw tickets to both property owners. And after the show, they were gung-ho to put it up. And, you know, by the way, the show was August 17th. So a dry time of year generally. So the last part of July or first part of August, you probably had the perfect weather conditions, never got wet. And then they, you know, built the building over the top of it and laughed and plastered it up for 130 some years before I carved into it.
Ron, just a few moments left. If we stop by the Corral Bar, I mean, can we see this thing now? It's up where we can take a look at it?
Oh, absolutely. We got the room. Actually, you can go on even online to or look at our website and get in the menu section. We got some different links. The Smithsonian, you know, got some pictures. There's some news stories out there that's got pictures of it, but it's nothing. You got to see it in person if you can get by. We're getting people coming from, you know, Europe, Switzerland, Germany, Australia, China. I mean, we've had a lot of people from travel from even outside the country as well as in the country, of course. They're all the same thing. They just kind of takes their breath away in the comments. They're just out of this world. You just can't imagine, it's just a time period. And I've kind of lost that freshness. And when I first, opened it up and took it, that head scratching, what year is this kind of thing,
So, well, Ron, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us.
Sure.
Ron Berger is the owner of the Corral Bar and Riverside Grill in the western Wisconsin city of Durand. We revisited that conversation with him from pre-COVID days. We talked about a massive old circus poster he uncovered in the restaurant a few years ago, the media coverage that followed. According to their Facebook page, you can still see it and dine in at the restaurant. But, of course, remember to observe mask mandates and safety precautions if you do, or maybe pencil it in for a trip when things get back to normal. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a profile of a Milwaukee musician.
Classic is an artist with many talents. The Milwaukee musician is a singer and multi-instrumentalist who creates unique modern soulful jazz compositions. He's won a number of awards over the last few years, including Best of Milwaukee Rap Hip Hop Producer for 3 years in a row by the Shepherd Express. Aisha Jaffer tells us more about Classic's musical journey.
Classic story begins surrounded by music.
Music for me began from birth of my parents always playing music for me in the car, in the crib. And then my musical journey started when I started playing the saxophone in the fourth grade.
He was a natural at the saxophone, which led him to a mentorship with Milwaukee jazz legend Berkeley Fudge. In addition to his time playing the sax with Fudge, Classic went through the Milwaukee public school system at Rufus King Elementary and Milwaukee High School of the Arts, surrounded by other creative students who helped develop his talent.
I've seen some things that you would find hard to believe. These ain't nightmares, these ain't dreams.
So I've been fortunate to be in a public schooling system that afforded us the opportunity to, like, make art all day and to pursue our passions. So that just did wonders for, like, confidence and just, like, creative freedom and just actually getting solid musical knowledge, but also not being restricted by that and, like, real-world applications. So all of that, like, supremely shaped who I am as an artist today.
Everything Classic seems to touch is done with real intention and purpose. And this comes through in his songwriting process.
It was really instilled in me that music is a conversation. And in any good conversation, there are pauses and you leave room for responses. And you in turn respond to something.
In this time of unrest in our new normal, Classic has kept active and created a deeper body of work. A journal of this time, but also his progress as a musician in his new mixtape, Class Notes.
They are notes on what was going on. I mean, the song Everybody Free, which is probably like my favorite. There was a lot going on that felt not free or felt like there were a lot of restrictions and being mindful of certain oppression that was being highlighted and me reflecting on that.
Free from whatever it is.
Just after the release of Class Notes, Joey Grijalva, author of Images of America, Milwaukee Jazz, was captured by Classic's sound and story and his intersections with the city of Milwaukee. Grijalva decided to reach out and start the process of writing the book on Classic.
This has been a transformative experience in and of itself. It's like my story, but it's like this interesting take of like using my story as also a vessel to tell different parts of the story of Milwaukee.
This story goes deeper, covering gun violence, trauma, loss, and also takes a look at anxiety, racism, and possibility. The book, The Milwaukeean, will be out February 2021.
People take time out of their day to digest from me. So it's got to be dope. It's got to say something. It's got to make you think. And it has to be honest. That's just like the criteria for, I think, everything that I do. I think my writing style is very stream of conscious. Conceptually, I can like flow from thing to thing pretty naturally because I'm just kind of following my life path and documenting it and hoping that people take something from that as well.
Aisha Jaffer brought us that story on Milwaukee Musician Classic. She's a radio freelancer and storyteller who lives in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we look at new transportation projects in Wisconsin aimed at improving the mobility of seniors and people with special needs. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, how much is an executive worth? Why is it so much more than those who work for them? 1A's listener-led series continues with a look at pay gaps, plus social media without President Trump. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Governor Tony Evers has announced that $3.8 million will be spent on improving transit for seniors and people with disabilities. These groups often face barriers to transportation. They may not be able to drive or have difficulty accessing public transportation. The money will go to almost 60 public and nonprofit agencies around the state to provide specialized transit services. Craig Thompson is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Previously, he was Executive Director of the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Craig, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, big picture, what kind of problems are you trying to tackle with these grants to communities all over Wisconsin?
Well, these grants are really, from my standpoint, a lifeline. We're talking a lot of times about fairly remote, more rural areas of the state, where if you're a senior or a person with physical or developmental disabilities, you know, you can truly be stranded without some of these services. So this money goes out to public and nonprofit agencies that generally, and a lot of times, it's buying a fleet of minivans, but it's also teaching the people how to access transit and is really a way to connect them with the community.
And this is an issue I've thought about a lot over the years. And Craig, this isn't just about getting around in some ways. It's something that's going to allow people to maybe stay in their community, to age in place, to not have to move to a whole new town just because they can't get around. Can you talk about how important this kind of thing is for people to be able to stay in the community that they know and love?
You know, that's exactly right, the way you just said it. You know, whether it be staying in their community or, as you said, staying in your home and not having to go to a nursing home. You know, mobility and transportation can be that one issue. And when you look at it even from a cost factor, it's, you know, the dollar goes a lot further by providing this mobility than what it would cost for somebody to have to live in a congregate setting. So, you know, it really is. It allows people to keep their independence and to stay in their home, as you had said.
Well, I think when people hear the phrase, you know, public transportation or mass transportation, they might think of, you know, a big set of bus routes or, you know, a light rail or subway. Obviously, for most Wisconsin communities, that's not in the cards. How much can we do with smaller options than that in these smaller communities?
Well, you know, that's where you get into specialized transit like these. And while we were really happy to talk about spending this $3.8 million, we had a lot more requests and need than this $3.8 million was able to cover this year. And part of that is because going back a couple years ago when I started in this job, we actually had a surplus in this program and because we weren't getting the word out well enough. And so we've really doubled down. We got the word out that surplus is gone, which is great because we provided more services to people. But now we didn't have enough money to cover the amount of need that's there. So we're glad that people are aware of it, that they're accessing it, but it's something that I think we're going to take a hard look in the upcoming budget to see if there isn't more we could do to help the people we weren't able to provide services to this year.
Can you key in on a couple of communities and how they're using this grant money?
Well, like I said, a lot of them, in some cases, they'll buy the actual minivans and pay staff. But then they're also looking at providing mobility management projects and coordinating services that are already there. and helping to teach people on how to access those. And some of the folks that work at these, they will literally, they'll run practice routes with the folks until they're comfortable with their schedules and how they can use the transit.
We're talking to Craig Thompson, head of the state's Department of Transportation, about a grant program that's helping communities around the state provide transportation options for seniors, people with disabilities in communities around the state. As you said, this is not a new program. How long has this been around?
Well, it really began in the 1970s, and so it's been around for quite some time. But I think, just recently, I think we're really starting to promote it more. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it in this show and just make more people aware that it's available. So we're seeing it, the demand really spike.
Has demand changed because of COVID-19 in one way or another?
Yeah, that's a great question. What COVID-19 has meant is that, you can only safely have one passenger per vehicle. So that really, stresses when you only have so many vehicles. So that's made it more challenging.
Now, if people in communities out there are hearing this and thinking, oh, I didn't know about this grant program. We want to get in on something like this. Is it still going to be around next year, as far as you know? And when can they start trying to apply for this?
Yes, it will be around next year. And like I said, I'm hoping we can maybe even take a look at it, perhaps increasing it. But the governor is going to introduce his budget in mid-February, and then it'll go through the process. But, next year, these nonprofits and folks that provide this can look at, putting in for accessing these dollars again.
And these are local efforts, as I understand it. This isn't, these aren't State Department of Transportation projects to start these things up. Who are the people taking the lead on making these things happen?
For this specific, there's two programs that are somewhat similar. And one is a county-run program, and that's through county departments of health and human services and the like. But this is nonprofits and other public agencies that have formed and, are really trying to provide a really valuable service. And so this funding is something that allows a lot of them to stay in business.
Switching gears in our last minute or so, this is a budget year in Wisconsin. We've been focusing in on this one particular part of our transportation budget. Big picture, what kind of things are you looking at in the coming couple of years that you're hoping to see funded?
Well, the last budget that was passed, we were very excited that there was bipartisan agreement to increase revenue for our transportation fund for the first time in really a generation. So in all of that increase, it was about $465 million. All of it went into fixing what we currently have, whether it's our two-lane state highways or for our local county, city, and town roads. So we've got a lot of projects going on out there. We're going to maintain that and try to accelerate that moving forward into the next budget.
Yeah, for people listening and thinking about the potholes maybe on Main Street in their downtown or over on the county highway, if they're worried, are we faster when it comes to that basic maintenance and upkeep? Are we turning those things over faster now with that budget from a couple years back?
We've got a lot of projects going out there, and even during the pandemic, we kept all the projects moving, and that's on state projects. And the locals, the counties and cities, towns and villages have been doing an extraordinary job, and we're working with them to try to streamline things so that they can get the money out on the road even faster.
And one more quick question. I'm still calling you the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. Any hope of a Senate confirmation taking that designee out of your title anytime soon?
I will leave that up to the elected officials when they want to do that. So in the meantime, we just keep doing our job.
Craig, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Craig Thompson is secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. We talked to us today about the state's recent efforts to improve transportation for seniors and those with special needs through a grant program providing funding to local projects. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, get a morning update on the impeachment effort in the nation's capital. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. And coming up here on Central Time, we'll talk more about that vote today from the U.S. House to, for a second time, impeach the president. We'll look at the result, get your comments, what you think of the vote, and what could happen in the U.S. Senate. The timing looks like probably nothing is going to happen between now and Inauguration Day. You can get in on that conversation now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.